All right, I'm going to call this meeting to order. Welcome to the April 12th, 2018 meeting of the Central Marin Sanitation Agency. Would you all please join me in the pledge of allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Katie, would you please call the roll?
Okay. Diane First?
Here.
Dean Giovanni?
Here.
Michael Borstein?
Here.
Thomas Gaffney?
Here.
And Dan Hummer?
Here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is open time for public participation. This is the time we set aside for members of the public to speak on items not on the agenda. Is there any member of the public who would like to speak?
No comments from the public.
Seeing none, we will move on to the consent calendar. The purpose of the consent calendar is to pass items that are routine. They will be enacted by one motion. Any member of the public, the Board of Commissioners or the staff can remove an item if they would like to discuss it. If anybody would like to remove any item, speak now. If not, I need a time
motion.
For 4-H? Okay.
And I have to remove the minutes because I wasn't here. I have to abstain from that.
Okay.
Remove
so
the balance of the consent count.
All right, so there's a motion to pass everything under item 4 with the exception of A and H. Do I hear a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? That passes unanimously. Let's take care of the minutes first. For A, was there anything to discuss?
Well, since I wasn't present, I'd like to abstain.
Thank you. If nobody else wants to discuss anything, I'll entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. One abstention. Thank you.
I had no public come to my room at the hotel.
I had no what?
I had no public.
Oh, good.
Even though I put the sign in the lobby.
Well, we were worried about that.
I was worried. The door was open.
Okay. 4-H. Associate and Assistant Engineer Job Descriptions. Dean, did you want to start?
Sure. The summary mentions getting into a little bit of managing, and with these skills or the duties of management listed as essential duties and responsibilities, I thought it would be good to get into the qualifications, perhaps under education and interpersonal skills, something to reflect that this is sort of a first step in supervising and managing within our organization at the agency. And I think it'd be good to start grooming those young level engineers in our agency to be stepping up into the next levels of supervisory and management positions.
So, are you specifically talking about the assistant engineer?
Associate. Excuse me, at the associate. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah.
Jumped right through that.
So, where does it talk about management specifically?
Two.
Okay, sorry. There it is.
And also in the bullet points of essential duties and responsibilities, it talks about consultant management and assist with management, bottom goal, assist with management of the agency's things. So you are starting to bridge into that, although you're not directly supervising staff with the hiring of them or the performance evaluations and appraisals.
You know, this would be good for our packet for, ongoing transitions or, what's that term, remember?
Succession?
Succession, yeah, thank you.
Is there any analysis that goes with these descriptions that aligns the requirements with the compensation? We'll make sure that any revisions that is suggested would be consistent with that sort of an analysis, so that you're not impacting the compensation by what you're putting into the requirement list unknowingly.
Yeah, we're not. From what Commissioner DiGiovanni is saying is we're not going to be adding anything else to the essential job functions. Usually, when you do like say a compensation survey, you look at organizations and similar title job descriptions. So you might look at associates, senior engineers. And you'll take a look at the essential job functions, experience, education. Make sure they're pretty close. It's never 100% perfect, but as long as they're 85%, 90% close enough, you say that's a good comparator for your compensation survey. So I was talking with Commissioner DiGiovanni about this a moment ago, and we thought, to address this, that we could just add, some language in the qualification section on page 2 under education and experience, just saying that, having some experience with managing, projects and consultants is desirable. We could say that, having some classes taken in, HR, supervision, personal management is desirable. We could add things like that.
As long as it's consistent with your past practice, that's fine.
Yeah. Is that accurate? Commissioner Dean Giovanni had some good ideas too. So if I could just get his sheet there before the end of the meeting, and we can make sure
that we
craft some language in those two sections.
And you wouldn't put it in the assistant engineer?
No. Not in the assistant, no.
Yeah, because, and actually that helps because the associate engineer is not a representative. It's a non-representative.
That's assistant. Correct, yeah.
And the assistant is.
That's right.
Okay.
And what I mentioned also, what I mentioned also is that, we have an internal engineer who's an assistant, and she recently passed her professional engineer, civil engineering license test. So she has that requirement. And I know her manager and I have been talking about him developing a development plan for her over the next year so she could meet some of the other key requirements in this job description so she could advance. And part of that development plan, which will be part of her work plan, will include, attending some various, employment law type of training classes that a lot of other, supervisory staff attend.
That's great. Do you need a motion to approve the descriptions?
Yeah.
To approve the description approve with some minor
modifications.
Yeah. Along the lines of management.
I think it'd be one motion to approve the assistant as presented and a second motion to approve the associate with, board comments.
Okay. I move we approve the assistant part of 4H.
Second.
Thank you. Is there any member of the public who'd like to speak to this? Seeing none.
No comments.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you. That passes unanimously.
Approve the associate with the minor additions from Dean.
Second.
Thank you. Any member of the public like to speak to this? Seeing none. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Unanimous. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
And thank you, Dean. Good comments.
You're welcome.
All right. Agenda item 5, the GASB 75 Actuarial Valuation Report.
Okay. Thank you, Chair, first. So CMSA has been working with North Bay Pensions since about 2010 to comply with our GASB 45 and now our GASB 75 reporting requirements. And there have been 3 GASB 45 valuations to date. And we've talked about these recently because, remember, last summer the Marin Civil Grand Jury issued a report on OPEB, valuations of the various, cities and towns and special districts. And there were various recommendations there, and we responded to those. And one of the responses is that we had to, we would post our GASB 45 and 75 valuation reports on the internet. So we talked a little bit about what the GASB requirements were and why we have to do this and what gets reported on the financial statements during those discussions. But earlier this year, we contacted Nick Franciskind, who's the actuary with North Bay Pensions, and said, we need to comply with GASB 75. Can you prepare the GASB 75 valuation report? And he said he would definitely do that. And so we provided all the agency information over to Nick. and he prepared the attached report. So both Ken and I have reviewed this. Ken understands it a little better than I do, which is a good thing. And so the staff report kind of summarized the high level of the findings. And Mr. Francis Kynes, I noted the staff report, couldn't make it to the meeting tonight because he has teaching obligations on Tuesday and Thursday evenings. But he said if he could definitely make it if the board wanted to meet at a different time and had some detailed questions or wanted a formal presentation, or he could even meet with the finance committee in the future if needed. But Ken's here tonight to present the high-level summary of the findings for you all.
Okay.
Ken.
Should I come up there or just do it from here?
You can do it right anywhere you want. It's all good.
If you are comfortable there, you can stay there.
Can I move up here to this table?
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah.
You don't need to move. Okay. I'll just kind of
Okay. Hello, everybody. I don't get to get in here much, and so it's kind of a pleasure to be here and to assist you with a background and description of our new GASB 75 actuarial valuation. And hopefully, anyway, you've had some kind of a chance to at least glance through it, before coming here to this meeting. Wanted to give you a little bit of just a very brief general background on our type of a plan. Our plan currently is for employee only, for those that are eligible for it. And for those that are eligible, they will receive a lifetime medical benefit, dropping to the Medicare rate at the age of 65. Okay, and then to move into plan funding, basically, according to the new actuarial evaluation, our new total plan obligation is about $5.2 million, which in the scheme of things is very low. I've seen, $30, $40, $50 million, actuarial evaluations, and so, $5 million is very low number. We have annual payments that are paid in connection with the actuarial evaluation. It used to be called the actuarially required contribution. Now it's called the actuarially determined contribution. There's just a little change in the language, but basically it's the payment that you make to fund the plan as well as to pay the current retirees receiving the benefit. So our current annual payment is roughly around $250,000. About $200,000 of that is paid to retirees currently receiving the benefit, and about $50,000 goes into the plan funding. Okay, to talk a little bit about how we manage the plan funding, we are paying the benefits directly to the employees themselves, retirees. And then the amount that we can contribute and submit to the plan, that just goes straight to the plan. We don't take any payments from the plan. And the reason why we do that is that if you have monies going into the plan as contributions and then you have monies going out of the plan as payments coming from the plan to retirees, then that reduces or lowers your average daily balance, and then in effect you would get lower interest earnings posted to your account. So we don't want to do that. We just make the contributions directly to the plan and then let those sit still, until we make another contribution. Okay. So basically what we're doing in effect is to fund the plan as quickly as possible by following that method. As quickly as possible, meaning, the dollar amount, that we get to contribute to the plan. It's not a large amount of money. When the plan is fully funded, the earnings from the plan will basically pay the benefits of the plan. That was one of the whole reasons for these actuarial evaluations in the first place for OPEB, was for the earnings from the plan to pay the plan benefits. So there may be some residual amount, but sometime, at some point in the future, when the plan is fully funded, the OPEB cost to the agency will drop way down because it'll all just be paid for by the plan. Okay. At that point in time, then we'll cut over and we'll have the plan administrator pay the benefits, and we won't pay those anymore, but we'll pay those until that time. Under the current conditions, I estimate that the plan will be fully funded in maybe 18 to 20 years, just giving the small amount that we're contributing. However, we can discuss paying a higher contribution if we wanted to do that. But nonetheless, the only thing that we're required to contribute is what the actuarial evaluation says, which is this $250,000. Okay. Just a couple of plan terms. Our plan Currently, because of the action that was taken back in 2010, it's closed to new hires. And so because of that, basically what we have is we have a finite group of people that are moving through this plan as time goes on. And the we have a total obligation now of this $5.2 million according to the actual evaluation. But that over time is going to drop because, people are going to, become through mortality, they're going to pass on, they're going to fall off the other end. And then also, of course, when a person turns 65, then the plan drops, or the medical benefit drops to the Medicare rate. And so, the obligation, to the agency is going to decrease. So we will see, decreases, in time, I'm guessing, maybe 10 to 15 years from now, but it will decrease. Okay?
One thing to add to that is, based on negotiations back in 2010, when we set up the trust fund, all employees hired after July 1st, 2010, they received that medical after retirement account benefit. They don't receive the Kaiser single payer retiree benefit.
That's correct. Yeah.
So that's why the plan is kind of closed to retirees before 2010 and employees who were hired before 2010 working at the agency.
So just a few of the big picture items having to do, with these two methodologies of calculating the OPEB obligation. Under the old original GASB 45, which came out quite some time ago, back in 2005 or something like that, you had, like I said before, you had what was called the actuarially required contribution. And under that method, basically the actuary determined or calculated the dollar amount that you were going to pay, and if you paid that amount, you didn't have any further obligation or liability that was recorded on the balance sheet. If you paid your bill, you were done. And then also the total obligation and then a lot of other information was just purely provided in the footnotes. So the information was always there in the financial statements, but it just wasn't on the face of the balance sheet. Okay, then now GASB 75 comes along, and I guess because of transparency and these kinds of things, people just want to know more about it. So now they've changed the terminology to the actuarially determined contribution, which it's just semantics. The number itself is identically the same, and now you put the net liability on the face of the balance sheet. So in our particular case, the total obligation is roughly $5.2 million. We have about $2.4, maybe $2.5 million in the fund, and so we have about a $2.5 million liability that we will be adding to our balance sheet for 6/30/18. Okay? And then also there's additional information, more tables and schedules and exhibits and things that are also required to be added to the footnotes to the financial statements. So there's just a whole lot of information about this GASB. And then, of course, on a separate side note, but it's the same thing, that's why I wanted to mention it, is that under pension rules also, it's the same format, with the obligation of all this expanded footnote disclosure. So there may be 3 or 4 or 5 pages of footnotes in the financial statements. It has all this stuff. And so anyway, it seems excessive to me, but that's just what it is. Okay, just a few of the key assumptions I wanted to mention is that these actuary evaluations follow what's called the entry age normal method. And so what that means is that an older person entering into the system would cost more to the agency than a younger person. So if someone is, say, like age 45, the assumption is you're going to retire at 55. The actuary calculates that the funding for the plan will be funded over that 10 years active service life of the person, and then you begin paying the benefit at age 55 when they assume to be retired, over their lifetime. So that's how they calculate the obligation. If someone started at say 30, then you would amortize that over a 25-year period of time, and so the cost to the agency would be much less. So that's how that works. Then there's the discount rate, and what that is the percentage of rate of return on investments over, that's just used, to calculate the rate of return, on the investments that are in the plan. And so those are used also for future projections. It's assumed that whatever your discount rate is, whatever you choose, in our particular case it's 7.28%. They assume you're going to earn 7.28%, over the life, and then when they calculate what this total obligation is way out into the future, then they discount it back to get the present value today, and that's why they call it a discount rate. So even though to me it really isn't a discount rate, it's an interest rate, but they call it a discount rate. Our current plan is yielding in excess of 9%. I've taken all the returns, back to the inception of the plan, scheduled it all out on a worksheet, and we've been garnering over 9%, from inception, to date. And so, there's a lot of talk about decreasing discount rates, and we're not decreasing our discount rate. We're just leaving it at the 7.28, which is what it was in the prior year, and we'll continue with that unless we see a change, in the actual return, that we're receiving. So that's it for my presentation, and we'll answer any questions that you may have.
And we have to update this every 2 years.
It's a two-year, yes, renewal.
All right. Any questions?
Well, I have a comment. You gave a great presentation of something that's basically undecipherable. and they passed GASB 75, but I don't know how it's going to help the public understand what we have. But we did have a comment earlier. And our comment was that, first of all, when we got compared at LAFCO, we were pretty good on this compared to, the grand jury.
That's right, yes.
And some other agencies.
And so we thought we should add in the background or the summary of the results that we actually are putting money in so that we will eventually have a zero liability.
That's correct.
We have a long-term plan to have a zero liability, and it's in force now. Some kind of description, that right in here in the background, and then it would go. We first thought maybe we should just have a little summary, just for us, But Jason was saying that this is going to go in our website. And so maybe we could have a little description of what we're doing.
Sure, we could do that. We could draft it up. And one thing we stated in there is because one of the other recommendations from the grand jury that we responded to positively is that they said your board should adopt a policy saying that you're going to fully fund your OPEB liability over time. And each year you're going to fund that annual required contribution, or the ADC, what it's called in GASB 75 now. And we responded back that we would adopt a policy by the end of last calendar year, and we brought that to the Finance Committee. We vetted it out. We created the policy. And it actually was just some language in an existing financial policy associated with our annual budget. Yeah. So we had a couple, additional provisions in there, and the board approved that. And actually, a few weeks after they approved it, the chair of the grand jury actually sent me a note asking what's the status of this. So I sent him the revised policy. Mm-hmm. So we could even talk about that funding policy being adopted by the board as we include that in the background section when we're telling our story.
And then also just on that same idea of describing the funding plan, the funding plan is also something that the credit rating agencies look for. Credit rating agencies. And so, if you're, in the market, that's something definitely that they would want to know and to note.
And it's so, very favorable that you're doing it.
Yes.
Then the fact that they discount it back, and get the present worth of it, basically, I spent all my lifetime trying to explain present worth to people, but you can't do it. I would really like to see the worksheets.
And I have that. Yeah.
Is it okay with the board if I review the worksheets? So I just because
I don't know, Tom.
Because here's my logical.
I'll lock all the cells.
We got 2.5. Yeah. Send a PDF.
I bet you did that to me one
give
time.
Give me a PDF. Give me a PDF. I don't want to be accused of changing assumptions or something.
Wait a minute. What happened to that number?
But really, we get this present value of 25 years ahead. What does that mean? And really, what I want to see is this year we expect to pay this amount of money. We're paying $250,000 a year. I think what's going to happen is we're going to be paying zero in about less than 20 years, isn't that right?
Yes, yeah, or close to it, yeah.
Well, the issue for most agencies is do you want to pay it off faster? And many people are in deciding how much they want.
And many people aren't. And the public thinks nobody is. You see, that was my point. That's why I wanted to put our plan in there.
But I will say this. The 10-year projection doesn't show any tapering off within 10 years. So people are going to look at that and be concerned.
Yeah.
And so I noticed that same thing. Yeah.
So well, maybe
first of all,
a comment
see,
on there.
They don't add up, though. What are they? Take a look at it.
There is individual pieces of information for each year. They don't add up or equal anything. each year.
The funny thing, to your point, Diane, also, is that some results in the report, it says that the average age of the retiree is 69, so I don't really quite get why it wouldn't be dropping off. But, yeah, kind of so.
You know, it also said somewhere in there that surviving the people in the plan, the people already retired, and their spouses. Do we pay for spouses?
No.
I'll show you.
We do for four employees that transferred from the San Rafael Sanitation District back when CMSA was formed.
Just four. Oh.
Part of that arrangement was that we provide medical after retirement for them, their spouse, and dependents. But three of those employees have passed away, so now we're just providing it for their spouse.
Mm-hmm. And dependents up to 21 or?
It just says dependents, but they don't have, we're not paying for any dependents. But that was in the contract for the transfer.
So, you know, and then a description that we, employees hired after 2010 are in a different program. Or something.
Yeah, we could add that too. Yeah. I think that's mentioned in there, but we'll take a look and we can add it to the background section so when someone looks at it, all that information is right there.
So the point is, when my neighbors ask me, I can say, at Central Oregon, we're fully funding our OPEB over, you know, the future, and it's, you know, in a reasonable manner. It's not a problem for us.
Would you like to put a comment or an explanation to that effect under Exhibit 7? Because this shows the cost going up for over 10 years, but then we can follow it by saying, however, beyond 10 years, we expect the numbers to drop, and our goal is to be fully funded by year 20 or whatever.
We'd have to see if the actuaries okay with adding that in there.
Yeah, I'd be careful making declarative statements that only invite an analysis by.
You can say a goal.
See, I don't think you can't say it in 7 because 7 is just three different things that are sitting there.
Just don't get out ahead of the staff. That's all I'm asking.
I think the main thing we're looking for is we're not sitting on our thumbs here. And whereas many other agencies seem to be out of control, we're really under control, and not only are we under control, we are planning to the future to have this fully paid off in approximately 20 years, so that then that isn't a liability for us anymore, and it will be just funded by the trust fund forever after that.
Mm-hmm. And it's reasonable funding by our district.
And that is our goal.
Yeah, and that's actually our policy.
Our policy.
Yeah.
On Exhibit 7, would it be true to put totals on the bottom and then say after, you know, this 2027 will be at 75% funded at that point?
I'm sorry.
What is the projected implicit rate?
Could you repeat that question?
So the question is, on Exhibit 7, if you were to total these expenses, at what funding level would that be at 10 years from now,
at the end
of year 2027?
Okay.
Where would we be based on just what is shown in Exhibit 7?
See,
okay.
I think adding expenses over a series of years makes you think, gee, we owe $2 million. Or something. You see, and really what we owe is about $200,000 a year, which we're paying. And that's all we have to pay.
Well, that's it.
Adding it all up.
It's right there.
No, I'm just saying, like, we're presenting information all the way up to year 2027 in Exhibit 7. I mean, after doing all that work up to 2027, where will we be at that point?
Why not just add funding level to it also, a fourth column, essentially?
Yeah, it's just like we show this information. I don't know what this Exhibit 7 really means, except it looks like we're paying into it.
Mm-hmm. I think Exhibit 7 is just a requirement in GASB 75 that you generate this Exhibit 7 with this information in it. I'd be careful about modifying this because it's not in compliance with 75. We can ask.
Oh, I didn't know this was a GASB required.
Yeah, these are GASB required because the tables in 4, in the prior ones were GASB 45 required, and they're completely different than these exhibits.
Okay.
I'd like to put our explanation in the background.
Yeah, the background is the best because that's just kind of summarizing things. That's where we can kind of, state what we're doing, what our policy is, and what the board's discussed.
Right. Stating what our policy is should be pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah.
Are we okay with just kind of limiting it to that?
Yes.
Tom, are you okay with that?
Well, I like, don't we want to say, well, okay, does our policy say that the, you know, the, we're going to pay it each year and the intent will be that it will complete?
Can we separate the agenda item from public relations work? Because if you want to message something, it's probably a separate conversation, not a focus.
I agree.
Vehicle that you want.
Yeah, but it's on.
But this is what will be on our website.
Yeah, this is
which is
be
our public outreach. So if they read in the grand jury that we suck,
no, that we have 2.5 million or whatever it is. That's all they read.
And the summary should give some background information. Please. And I think stating our policy is a perfect place for that.
Yeah,
I do too.
By stating that. It is the policy of CMSA to have this completely paid off by 2037 or 2036.
The intent when we kind of are talking about this, you know, the board made certain decisions back in 2010 that we had to make for the actuary to construct this. And there were some options under 45. So we picked the accounting method. We picked the amortization period. We picked the discount rate, among some other things.
Sure.
And the amortization period at that time was the 30 years. So the idea was that that investment rate, and based on all the assumptions at that point in time, it'd be fully funded in 30 years. Now, I think we're ahead of that right now because subsequent to that, the board said all new employees after this date, they're not going to have this same high-level benefit. So that's kind of put bookends on the group we're talking about. So the liability is reduced a little. And we have now the funding policy in place. And, yeah.
So basically it's what you're describing, to leave the actuarial as is and then just add our information as like supplementary information to this.
In the background.
Okay.
Change numbers that are required by GASP.
Correct. But instead insert some information in towards the beginning of the report under summary results background stating that
We're on track, and we've got a policy.
So it'll be before the 30 years because of these changes.
Yeah.
Unless the investment returns drop really low.
You know, we expect to be fully funded, but you know, depending on everything.
Yeah, we can craft some basic policy language based on prior board decisions and actions we've taken. Send it to the actuary and have them. There's some other edits that we want to make in here anyways that we found. And we could just say we'd like this inserted in the background section. And we're thinking that he'd be fine with that since we're not changing any of the GASB 75 required, you know, tables and exhibits.
And this is his report.
Yeah, that's right. So he needs to approve what we want to include in it.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions or comments?
Yeah.
All right. I had a couple of things. Is the discount rate assumption of, what was it, 7.28?
7.28, that's correct.
Is that too high? You said that over the life of this work, the actual number is around 9.
Mm-hmm.
But what is it like for the last 3 years? What do we anticipate it will be for the next 7 to 10 years?
Yeah, what's
is
the
7.28?
Life of this? What's the life of this? You said for the life, we've earned 9%.
We've been receiving 9% on average since inception of the plan back in 2010. I believe it was. 9 or 10. But I think it was 9.
Yeah, it's been a really good stock market at the time.
Right, but what are we anticipating for the next?
We're assuming 7.28 on average going forward.
Are we okay with that?
Our view is that when we actually see changes, if it's decreasing, you know, then we might change it. But we just don't see any point in changing it, you know, if we continue to receive, you know, a very good, you know, rate of return.
Okay.
And this will be updated every 2 years also. When we talk to Nick, you know, and, you know, 1.75 years from now about updating the report, we'll take a look at the investment returns and we'll let the board know. If it looks like it's getting a lot worse, we may want to consider changing the discount rate. But that'd be something we'd bring to you for you to decide.
If we change the discount rate, we reduce our earnings rate.
And it increases the obligation.
And we reduce the present value at a lower discount rate.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, we increase it. If you have a higher discount rate, the present value goes up.
Well, the value of the assets doesn't go up as much, and so therefore that lets the remaining liability increase.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also the discounted present value.
That's different too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, fine. I would just encourage you to be very conservative about that and keep an eye on that.
And we are, and our view was that the 9%, you know, and actually it's like 9.2, you know, is the actual percentage, and we thought that, well, okay, we're being conservative by just leaving at the 7.28 because that's what it was in the prior year already.
Okay. But it's so probably high overall.
My next question is on page 8, the exhibit 4, OPEB expense. The very last figure on that page is the 253. That's, I'm presuming, what you're describing as our annual...
annual expense. Required contribution, right.
But at the beginning of that paragraph, it mentions that OPEB expense is of 283.
That's one of the typos that he needs
got
to correct.
Got it, okay.
Yeah.
So when Nick originally did this, he had a different lower discount rate, so all the figures were different. And we looked, and Ken looked at the rate of return and said... we think 7.28 is fine for this 2-year period because we've been getting 9+ over the last, you know, 8 years. So he didn't update that.
I'm so accustomed to reading these reports and nothing ever adds up to what I think it will add up to, that I'm just like, okay, what am I getting wrong? Okay.
And I noticed places where a number was negative, it should have had brackets on it, didn't have brackets, and so
there's a lot of cleanup to be done.
Yeah.
Not a problem. And then just out of curiosity, when will this be on the website?
Well, after tonight, we're going to probably early next week, we'll have a conference call with Nick, and we have some other basic questions in here mm-hmm. that we're going to answer just for our own knowledge, and then there'll be a few edits. We'll have the policy language drafted up and presented to him. It may be on the website within, you know, a couple weeks, depending on his schedule about making the changes.
Fine.
By the next board meeting, for sure.
Okay, good. Any other questions or comments?
On the website,
right? So there is no public for me to ask if they have any questions or comments.
So do we accept it, or
I'll move that we accept the agency's GASB 75 evaluation report and as directed.
Okay. Second.
Okay. With
minor changes.
Corrections.
As directed with those minor changes.
Minor changes and corrections.
Yes. And we'll make sure we note those in the minutes what the changes were.
Thank you. All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? That was unanimous. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for all the good questions and comments.
Thank you. And Tom, I have your kind of figure you might ask.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Ken. Thanks, Ken.
Bye, public. Thanks very much.
All right, agenda item 6, revised recruitment and selection policy, personnel policy number 208.
Thank you. So, yeah, the agency has a personnel policy and procedure manual, and it's we update it every 3 years, and that's we review it internally, we review it with the employment law attorney, we review it with, you know, with SEIU Local 1021. We bring revised policies back to the board for consideration approval. But what happens between those, that 3-year period review cycle, is that there's usually some changes in federal or state law that affect some of our policies. Then we'll work with the employment law attorney to update the appropriate policies and bring those to the board. So that's the case tonight, is that there was a law that passed on January 1st of this year, which required some revisions in our recruitment and selection policy from the personnel policy manual. And that was a legislation that essentially says that in your job applications, you can't have a question asking if they've ever had a criminal conviction of a felony. We had that language under the yes or no checkbox, and then you wanted a description of what the conviction was. So we'd have to remove that to comply with the new law. And in the recruitment policy, we have to make sure that we don't perform a criminal background check before we make the conditional offer of employment. Before we do that, you know, as part of the evaluation of the top applicants. But because of the law, we have to do it after we've done our evaluation, we selected the top applicant, and we've made the conditional job offer. So, you know, we learned about this at an employment law conference recently, and then we talked with our employment law attorney, and we made some edits to the policy, which are shown in blue. So I can answer any questions on the revision of the policy, but we're in compliance with the new law with this.
Good thing they don't have board members.
Oh,
So you make the conditional offer.
Yeah.
And then you do
the criminal background check.
And so what if you find out there's something nefarious about the person?
That would be a condition.
Yeah, what we do is we look at the results, and then we have to make a determination if it was significant and it would affect, you know, their performance as an employee, as working with others, if it impacted any of their essential job functions. And if it did, then what we do, we contact the employment law attorney, share with them the background check information, what our concerns were. And then there's a whole other process in the law that we didn't include in the policy where we have to allow them to respond, you know, to the findings, allow them to consider, ask for reconsideration based on their response and other steps in the process. So if we found that, then we'd, you know, we'd talk to the attorney and figure out what those steps exactly were and how we navigate through that part of the law. We didn't want to try to capture that in the policy where our staff may just do that on their own because it's pretty legalistic and we will make sure we minimize our exposure.
You'd make a judgment if, you know, if I want you to, I don't know, get one.
Like an example that Jason used earlier today was when they were 17, they did something really
stole
stupid.
Stole a car or something.
Or were, you know, they did something really stupid, but then they went off to college, they got a master's degree, they got a PE now, and they're a family man and the Cub Scout master. You know, you could look at that and say, okay, he's 17 and he's great now.
That's a good example. We probably would just we'd waive that and say it's not going to impact him as an employee here or any other.
And you wouldn't. That would be confidential, but staff wouldn't.
Yeah, that's all. Anything associated with medical evaluations, a criminal background check, functional capacity test, that's all confidential.
Yeah.
Only people with the need to know would have that information, and that's a very small group of people, which is probably me and. Yeah.
Well, it's the law anyway, so.
Any other questions or comments?
I like the changes we made.
Yeah, I'm reminded of an issue of a magazine called National Lampoon, where there was a whole page of exploding toilet stories on the back. Like somebody could be serial.
Toilet exploder?
Bomber, yeah.
Okay, I think we're getting a little off agenda now. Any other questions or comments? No members of the public? Thank you.
I'll move that we approve the revised personnel policy to
I think Michael, I'm giving that one to Michael. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Agenda item 7, Operations Department Succession Planning.
Okay, thank you, Chair, first. So for this fiscal year, we had prepared a succession plan primarily for operations and maintenance staff, and we've implemented portions of that plan so far. For example, we had a utility worker retire, and we just recruited and replaced for that utility worker. We had an operator retire, and we recruited and replaced for the operator. Then back in December, if you recall, we had an element of our maintenance succession plan where a long-time electrical instrumentation supervisor is planning to retire at the end of this fiscal year. We requested authorization to recruit for an E&I technician, you know, in advance of the supervisor's retirement so we could have some training and transition, you know, activities, which you all approved. This is another element of the operations department succession plan where we need some board approval, and that is creating a new position called assistant operations supervisor. This is a position that we've had in the past for other types of operations successions. For example, we had an individual, Chris, you probably don't know Chris, he's our plant manager. We created this position so he could move up internally. We did a recruitment, moved up to operations assistant operations supervisor. He did well there. Then when a supervisor retired, Chris moved into the supervisor position when he met the qualifications. Then we kind of retired the position. Then when our plant manager, Nathan Brennan, decided he'd retire, he gave us 18 months notice. We created an assistant treatment plant manager position, moved Chris into that so Nathan could train him for 18 months and mentor him. And then when Nathan retired, we moved Chris up because he, you know, was a pretty good assistant treatment plant manager, and he's been doing fine in the job. So what we did is we took the assistant operations supervisor that was several years old. We updated the job description. in the compensation range. The compensation is a little between the lead and the first few steps in operations supervisor, so there's room for growth for lead operators. And we decided that we would conduct an internal recruitment because we have two lead operators that are very qualified, and we'd like to see them move up eventually to an operations supervisor. So the plan is to create the position, have the internal recruitment, move hopefully one of those individuals into the position, and then they'd stay in the position until an operations supervisor retired, and then they met whatever competency requirements the plant manager, you know, establishes for them through their work plans over the next couple of years. So that's kind of in summary what this part of the plan is. So our recommendation is to approve the revised and updated systems operations supervisor job description and the compensation range, which is listed in the summary section in the staff report. And I can answer any questions.
Any questions?
Well, on this one, we don't have the advantage of the old manager mentoring and training the other, because the old treatment plant manager's on leave, isn't he?
We have two operations supervisor positions, and that's because we staff, you know, 7 days a week, 24/7. So
we do have somebody.
Yeah, and they work 4/10s, so they're here 3 days as a supervisor, then they have 1 day of overlap.
Oh, excellent. Okay. That's another one of our succession memos that was in that file.
Yeah, I put it in there already. Yeah.
Right.
That's the way to do it, I think.
I just have one comment. It's just, my comment is to note that we are just doing internal recruitment. We're not posting to the outside. In a matter of our disclosure of how we hire people, and we've discussed that at the last couple of meetings and stuff, that this is internal for good reason. We have a strong couple candidates that that can fill the position, as well as it's just great for staff morale to know there's promotional opportunities within the organization too, and keeps them motivated and interested. So I just wanted to note that we are only going internal here.
Yeah. And Dean and I talked about this briefly before the meeting started. And one thing I mentioned is that in operations, we've had a very challenging time recruiting graded operators. And it's because you're drawing from a very small pool of operators from other wastewater treatment plants in the region. And a lot of people don't want to commute to Marin County, or they don't want to buy a house here, especially if they're operations staff for some reason. So because of, you know, many unsuccessful recruitments through the 2000s, from like 2000 to 2005, we decided internally that we're going to try to openly recruit for operator and training positions, and then just train and promote the staff internally. We have very, very detailed training and development requirements for each grade of operator. So to move from like an OIT to an operator one, there's probably like, you know, 60 different requirements for operator one that you get trained on, you have to demonstrate competency in, to move up, in addition to having certifications and training and time in the position. Then we have the same type of requirements for grade two and grade three, for lead operator, and then for operator in charge. So there is a lot of training and development, you know, for the operations staff that these individuals have went through at the agency.
Great. Yep. Okay. Any member of the public? Seeing none.
I'll move that we approve the assistant operations supervisor job description and compensation range, and authorize the general manager to add the position to the agency's organization structure to allow implementation of the operations department succession plan.
Thank you.
I'll second.
Kate, you can figure that one out. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? No. Excellent. All right, moving on to the draft 2018 CMSA Joint Powers Agreement. Review.
Okay, so, you know, we have a JPA review committee, which is comprised, which the member agency is appointed, you know, representative to. So that's, you know, Chair Furs from SD2. It's Commissioner Homer from City of Larkspur, Mary Beth Bushy from Ross Valley Sanitary District, from Central Sanitation District, and Doug Kelly from Ross Valley San. And I've been working with them, you know, since I think it was like April of last year, to review, you know, 26 sections of the JPA, revise those in different groupings, and each of these groupings would then go to each of the respective member agency boards for review, discussion, and, you know, at some point approval. And in December of last year, I gave the board an update, you know, on the project. So there's the intent of this staff report is one is to give you another update, and also to let you know that we had a tough time scheduling our last review committee meeting. So in talking with chair first and committee members, we decided let's go ahead and just have the CMSA board as an extension of the committee, that you provide, you know, your feedback on the revisions. And there's a couple decisions to make in here. And based on our discussion, I'll make whatever edits to this draft JPA that's attached, and I'll provide it to the JPA managers. Then they'll bring it back to their respective boards for review and discussion. So with that, in the staff report, I kind of note what some of the you know, changes have been since the committee reviewed it last. But I can kind of walk you through the JPA agreement really quick, page by page, and just kind of note what the changes are, if that's okay. So one thing that changed is that the Board of Sanitary District Number 1 passed a resolution changing their name officially to Ross Valley Sanitary District. So we created a whereas statement in the recital section stating that. Then we went through the documents and replaced SD1 with RVSD. So that was one thing we did. Also,
the good news about that is that we don't have to replace all the manhole covers in the entire district.
That's a good thing.
We're leaving them as they were.
And then another minor change was that the original JPA referred to CMSA as the agency. So all the references were the agency. And then in amendments to the JPA, we were called CMSA. And then the exhibits and some of the changes that the committee's made, we titled it CMSA. And that caused some confusion during the review of the new JPA document. So for this document before you, we just changed everything to CMSA. So all the old references to the agency, those have been changed to CMSA.
Here's an SD1.
There should be there. Where is that? Yeah, because that whereas is reflective of what happened in the past, because when you were SD1, you annexed Larkspur. So we left that in there, but all the other references are to RVSD. We even took out the definition of SD1.
Found an agency.
Okay, yeah, you can tell me what that is. That's great.
It's two paragraphs down from where you eliminated your agency. So page one. Whereas
in 1979,
JPA.
Six times.
On the agency stand, each member.
Oh, okay. Great. That's all right. Well, like that. Thank you. I only caught like 40 of those agencies.
40. You can do a search.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We didn't define SANI too.
You know, that was, you know, Commissioner Gaffney mentioned that to me, and it was in a previous versions we had SD2 definition, and during the editing process it got dropped off. But what I did is once I learned about that this afternoon, I went back into this version. I added the SD2 definition back in.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did. So on page 2, there's the whereas statement with the Ross Valley Board decision. Then we took a look at the definitions. We put them in alphabetical order. And then we also remove definitions that are no longer applicable to the revised JPA. And then there was a comment from a Ross Valley attorney about language in the capacity charge and regional charge definitions that really weren't definitions. They're more explanatory. So I've removed those from the definition and placed them in another location in the JPA, which I'll point out in a moment.
This is an agency under H. Mm-hmm.
Man,
first line.
No. I'm glad you're catching
that. That's good. Out.
So then I just walking through, you to see there's CMSA changes and RSVD changes. Then we get to page 9, and this is where I kind of revised and added the capacity charge language on the top in section 14C. So that says the capacity charge can be collected by either the member or CMSA. I caught that one there. But if it's collected by the member, then they'll collect it when they collect their connection fee, and they'll remit it to us as CMSA. And that's kind of that's been the process since 1985. Then another change under Section 15 is that we actually own two parcels, the parcel that the facility is on, then the parcel across Anderson Drive. So we researched that, the county, so we added that parcel number. And then our outfall is on our property, plus it goes through a series of easements out underneath 580 along Morphew, you know, Street and other streets out by Santa Fe Public Works out into the bay. So if we wanted to add that to the definition, so it's just, it's very clear. Then on page 10, we have a revised language in 16F and then in both the indemnification sections. And this was suggested by the attorney with Sanitary District Number 2, and the JP manager is kind of wordsmithed a little bit, but it makes a lot of sense to us. And this just addresses the issue that San Rafael, Ross Valley, and SD2 are listed in the CMSA MPDS permit. So if an agency, any one of the agencies, doesn't comply or meet a permit obligation, then they'll indemnify the other agencies if there's any fee or any administrative action or a third-party lawsuit. So this is kind of language that we are hoping to have in the actual permit, but the Regional Water Board didn't want to add it to the permit, so it was a great addition by SD2's attorney to include that protective language in the JPA agreement.
Okay. You know, when the F, it says, and a JPA agency, should be a member. And a member.
Sorry, where?
Under JPA F. Agencies. Under F.
Permits where CMSA and.
And JPA agencies and.
And members.
JPA
A JPA member?
Members are listed as co-permittees.
Whereas CMSA and members. I think it should say.
Yeah, we can say members because members.
And member agencies?
Just members.
Just members because it's that.
Okay,
there's a definition for members.
Yeah, there's another agency down here.
Oh, yeah, I see there too. Okay. I thought I was just so good when I was doing that editing.
I'm not very good at
If Kate would have done it, we wouldn't find any agencies in here. I can guarantee that.
I found one on page 11.
Agency members.
Section 19A. The title. Agency managers.
Informal dispute among.
Oh, that's just supposed to mean that, like, the agencies, any manager from any agency. That's not
okay.
CMSA is the agency. And that's where the confusion came in, because this was a new section which has all the details of the dispute resolution process. And there was member, there were district, there was agency, there were agencies, there was the CMSA agency. So we figured get rid of the CMSA agency definition and just.
Keep saying members. Managers from each member shall be, don't you mean?
Well, see, that is a generic agency because CMSA is an agency and the members are agencies.
Okay.
So it covers CMSA or any of the GPA member agencies.
Okay. As long as we're consistent, I'll believe.
Yeah, we tried to be very consistent with that in this dispute resolution section. So are you guys okay with the indemnification language?
Yes.
Okay, great.
I think it's a good addition.
Yes. Okay, excellent. Thank you.
We've got a lot of agencies here.
Then the next really key decision is under Section 20, withdrawal. So remember, this used to say withdrawal and dissolution, and the committee agreed, let's just eliminate the dissolution. And what went to the boards was item 1A, where it says if a member's governing board decides to withdraw, they can do that, and then the members get together. And
I actually want to change my preference.
Okay.
I think the council's recommended language is better, which is shown as number 3. It's in blue.
Yeah, that's from the bond council, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the best.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Okay.
You mean alone or with the others?
Alone.
So let's maybe do it one step at a time. So the first decision is, do we want to have a withdrawal section or not? Mary Beth, when I talked to her on the phone, she said, why do we have a withdrawal section? Just be silent on it.
I'm okay eliminating it, but if we have to have one, I would prefer the council's recommendation.
See, he's not recommending that to stand on its own. He's recommending that with...
Yeah, he says if you have a withdrawal section, you need to include that.
In addition to items 1, 2, and 2.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
One step at a time. Right?
So the first step is, do we want to have a withdrawal section or not? What's our recommendation to the boards?
I'm okay with that.
What? In practicality, what if Sandra Fell withdrew from...
You talk about it.
What are they going to dump their
sewage?
That's
the worst thing.
They're just going to build their own plant and dump it in the bay?
What they could do is they could withdraw and they say, we just want to contract with you directly. We don't want to sit on your board. You just develop a fee structure for us and we'll pay the fee. I mean, they could do something like that.
The language as it stands now, if a member agency board decides to withdraw, we'll convene a meeting to discuss the withdrawal process.
No.
What are we going to talk about? The 49ers? No. We're going to talk about money.
Can I head this all off?
Yeah.
There's a context here. And you know what about the context because you were not on the board, but heavily active up to a decade or more ago. So if we're going to get into this, we're going to talk about all those rate increases where nothing got done except the Ross Valley grew into a double the size of the organization it was intended to be. So we're going to talk about context if we're going to talk about withdrawal. I prefer not to have it in there, and if we want to talk about withdrawal at the right time, we frame a process for it. But I'm not going to have provisions put into this JPA to hem me, hem Larkspur in, and not take into account the context.
Well, I don't think it's talking about Larkspur at all.
I'm just saying, the red language under the withdrawal section, in my opinion, starts to head in the direction I don't want it to go. I think if we want to include what's in the blue language, which just sticks to what the requirements are under the JPA, that's fine.
But if we leave
the... But in terms of laying out what members' responsibilities to other members are, somehow I don't think that's fair enough for this opinion.
What if we just left the withdrawal out and say, if that should happen to come up in the future, we'll meet and...
That's 1A.
Yeah, that's 1A.
That's okay with me.
I think it's the worst.
Because this goes back to LAFCO's consolidation discussion.
Well, I don't know. I was so unimpressed with LAFCO, I didn't pay any attention to what they said. I just think...
Well, I'm saying there's a reckoning coming. And we can acknowledge it and leave room for it. But if you want to try to describe under what conditions withdrawal might happen, I don't think you're going to...
Well, all I want to do is say you can withdraw if you want, but it doesn't create a liability for the other members. That's what I want to say. That's what 3 is interested in.
I'm okay with 3.
2 touches on it a little bit too, but it's a little convoluted. Okay, so let me go out there. Does anybody prefer 1B over 1A?
Me. Following the members' withdrawal, the member conveying the... I don't like 1B.
And you know, Doug Kelly didn't like 1B either.
All right, so I think 1B's out, right?
Okay,
or would anybody like to retain 1B?
No.
Okay. Does anybody... Let's go through these one at a time.
Yeah, let's do 1A.
Is 1A acceptable to everybody?
Sure.
No, absolutely not acceptable to me. It's exactly what I don't want to say.
Okay.
We're going to discuss it. It means that if somebody wants to withdraw, what are they going to discuss? Compensation for payments they've made in the past. An easy one would be, hey, I paid 50, you know, we pay 49% of all those reserve funds that you have.
You can combine 1A and 2 and say,
right,
if a member's governing board decides to withdraw, then you say, from the JPA, the member shall not receive or be entitled to receive any financial or material compensation.
Well, that's perfectly okay.
You can just combine them into one statement.
But, and 1A doesn't say the withdrawal will be approved. It just simply says it will be discussed.
Right.
You put a semicolon 2, and 2,
semicolon, and three.
That's what I would like. That'll be fine with me.
It's all inclusive.
Okay.
It's not one.
Everybody good with that?
I think that's really decision. Smart.
Okay, so under one.
A, delete the A.
Okay.
And two.
Intervene.
And three. So add ands.
Okay, so under the first sentence now, if a member's governing board decides to withdraw from the CMSA JPA, then we say.
To discuss the withdrawal process in detail.
We'll convene a meeting to discuss withdrawal process.
I don't think we put it in.
I don't think
it's just all of it. It's just one, two, and three.
Again, two.
They will all apply.
Yeah. That's fine with me.
I object to the words in two that say, for this agreement, I don't think it's appropriate that there's kind of a judgmental statement about members not being entitled to receive any financial or material compensation from the remaining members. That doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, it does. That's what you're going to discuss.
How about if we...
Well, if two members sue each other outside of this JPA agreement, this statement means nothing.
Well, okay, how about...
If we don't put
if
it
we
in...
If we limit this to just related to assets and operating...
If it's
revenues and expenses of CMSA.
If there's CMSA material issues we're talking about, it should be included. If it's not in the CMSA.
And then we could maybe add a sentence at the end to say this provision
doesn't three does cover
not,
the same thing?
No.
No, does That's not relate to any financial relationships or obligations between, you know, outside of the operations of CMSA, something like that, so that we're not talking about a side agreement under a separate JPA, such as Larkspur may have with Ross Valley or somebody else might have with somebody else. Outside of CMSA.
Well, our city attorney has to, and our council has to.
Right, but maybe if we have this, that'll help.
Amazing here, so.
Does that make sense?
Okay, just under.
I'm not an attorney, so I don't.
Okay, so we're going to. So at the end of two, which won't be a two, it's its own paragraph,
yeah.
We'll say this provision does not pertain to.
Agreements outside of the J. Related to the J2A or something like that.
The CMSA JPA.
The JPA.
Agreements between members.
This is not aimed at Larkspur at all. This is aimed at...
I understand.
This is aimed at... What if in 10 years we have a six-year drought? And, package treatment plants can be operated. And somebody decides to operate a package treatment plant to reclaim that valuable water. It's being done in about 30 places in California right now where they're using wastewater and treating it, and it becomes part of a potable water system. They got one in Dublin Santa Rosa Sanitary District, and they can inject it into groundwater. I mean, that's kind of what I'm thinking about, is that, okay, go do it if you want, but don't expect to get your 50, have us pay for it.
Right.
Go do it, but don't, fine.
No, I think we get that. But yeah. But I understand Dan's trying to say also.
We don't want
to preclude any
outside
claims have nothing to do with CMSA.
Say a few years or 5 years from now, Larkspur, as an example, wants to revisit the consolidation conversation. I want the flexibility in our agreements.
I think that's not precluded by this.
Well, I just think it ought to stick to CMSA's business, and if it's not CMSA's business, it should.
Okay, so what does this say that's not CMSA? Fine, add a sentence in there. It's CMSA business
just
only.
Just the members
CMSA
shall,
only.
You know,
entitled to any financial or other material compensation from remaining members. I just
because of the withdrawal. How about because
due,
of the,
yeah.
due to the withdrawal?
Well, the indemnification language is in there.
Well, it doesn't have to do that.
Okay,
we may agree to disagree.
Yeah. Are you understanding what the concern is?
I want our attorneys to figure this out.
So what I have so far is just at the end of that last sentence in two, saying this provision does not pertain to any separate agreements between members.
Yeah, okay. Or agreements or disputes or anything like that.
As I say, I'm going to let our city attorney decide how many times they want to hear.
In essence,
any agreements or disputes.
In essence, we're just talking about the assets and obligations of CMSA, and that's it.
Right.
And that's all we're pertaining these provisions of withdrawal for.
Yeah.
It's just pertaining to the assets and liabilities of this organization and whatever side agreements that other cities or members have within or amongst each other that have nothing to do with these assets or liabilities. Then
I'm sure our different councils will review this and come up with the fewest possible words to say on that.
Well, why don't we have your attorney look at it? He's going to do it anyway.
We're going to do it anyway.
I agree. I think that's where we should take this.
Okay.
I kind of like 1A, 2, and 3.
I think that's
and 2 with the additional sentence. That
and
we
2 need some wordsmithing.
Right. A little wordsmithing.
Okay.
I'll just say, why say it if you have to backtrack with a sentence at the end?
Well, it sounds like we have the
we could
simply just say the member seeking withdrawal from the JPA should not receive or be entitled to any financial or other material compensation from CMSA. Because they're leaving CMSA, and that way they have no financial contribution or anything from any of the assets and resources and investments and cash we have.
From CMSA or JPA members related to that withdrawal.
Related to the withdrawal.
I don't know enough to say that that's true. I'm going to have our attorney look at it.
Have your attorney look at it. Yes. This isn't the final word.
I understand.
This is just simply trying to...
I'll say the member shall see withdrawal from JP shall not receive or be entitled to any financial or material compensation from CMSA or the main members relating to the withdrawal. Then I'll say it does not pertain to any separate agreements between the members.
Agreements or disputes.
Agreements or disputes. And then the rest of that paragraph, I'll just delete.
Okay.
So this will be coming from the committee, then each of the agencies can consider all of this, and then...
But you'll be talking over with the managers so that they can get their attorney's input before it comes to the each member board, right?
I could suggest that to them, to have their attorney's review.
Yeah, I think one more go-around, like, for instance, just cleaning up that section before it comes to the member agencies.
Yeah, I guess what would happen then is if, say, all the attorneys have different thoughts on that section, then we have, say, four different, modifications to number two, then there needs to be either that goes to everybody with the four options, or the committee has to winnow it down to one option, then present one option to. It depends on if you want the committee to review it again, just this
or
section.
The managers.
Is there time for another committee?
See, the managers, we could suggest that they select one of the versions if there were four different versions, or we might think one's the best.
Why don't we bring it back to the board?
That's fine, too. You know what? I feel like we are way ahead of schedule on this anyway.
Sure.
It's gone so smoothly. So if you don't mind taking an extra month to bring it back to this board, if it turns out there's multiple versions.
Okay. So what I'll do is I'm going to make the changes we agreed to tonight. I'll give it to the manager and say, here's this final draft. Please have your attorneys look specifically at the section, the withdrawal section language that the committee and CMSA board has crafted, and either accept it or propose revisions, and then the managers will look at it, then we'll bring it back to this board.
Get the attorney.
Sounds good.
And we'll bring back just the withdrawal section to this board.
Okay. That process works.
Since everything else has been kind of, vetted.
Well, I do have one more sticky comment to make.
Oh, my, yes.
Yeah. And there's been discussion that, in fact, it was during the LAFCO study. I'm pretty sure Larkspur said they would review their membership on the JPA if requested by CMSA. And so, you know, I would like you to review your membership on the JPA. And I'm willing to accept anything. But the fact that, you know, you don't do wastewater and have any impact on that, you're just, you know, it's like the town of Ross doesn't have any.
I'm sure you'll show us where it says that and CMSA can take the right action.
Well, the board, I would like you, what it said, I'm pretty sure in your letter, was that the council would discuss it at a city council if CMSA requested. And I guess I'll show you the letter. I'll find it.
Okay.
Well, maybe we should put that on an agenda for the next meeting. Is there any discussion about that?
Yeah, we could add that to the agenda if you guys. Okay.
Sooner the better.
Yep.
So we'll add that as direction for this item. Okay.
Just for my edification, it has nothing to do with this. I know you helped write the original JPA 1,000 years ago. Well, it wasn't quite 1,000, but close. What happened in 1990-ish that Larkspur wanted to or had to be annexed to Ross Valley? What happened at that time? I mean, I would. I'm just
Larkspur
curious.
Larkspur its own collection agency?
Yeah, they did. They had their own collection agency, and I guess they, you know, at the time decided they didn't want to do it anymore. And there were a lot of, upgrades that needed to be made, and so they turned it over to the district. And Larkspur was funding in sewer entirely from property taxes, and then when Prop 13 passed in 78, they switched to service charges, as did Ross Valley and Sandy 2. And SRSD had already done it a couple years before, 74. And so then all of the property taxes that were used, you know, first of all, we all lost property taxes, a lot of them. So they went to the general funds, you know, so Larkspur, like every other city, put the sewer property tax on general fund and then converted to service charges. And so what happened then was Ross Valley said they should get the Larkspur vote on this board. And that would have been, that was the one I was, you know, I didn't see, you know. So then that's, but Larkspur decided to keep the vote, and I think the board wanted them to have the vote so that there wasn't, you know, 50% vote from one agency.
Okay. All right.
I don't know if the discussion ever was should it go down to 5 members. I don't, you know,
okay. We're getting slightly off topic here.
No,
it's part of the governing board.
Yes, it's part of the governing board. But it would be good to cover the background as we talk next time about
If it's in the files of CMS.
You don't have to get into the weeds, just the basics.
I know some general history of it, and it was pretty political. And at one point in time, I looked back, and back before you had email, there were lots of letters going between agencies.
Yeah.
And we used to have information packets like that had, like, you know, 30 letters and things in them. And I remember going back in the, you know, early 1990s when this annexation was being, you know, discussed between Larkspur and Ross Valley, and looking at some of the letters, you know, a lot of back and forth about, you know, we, you know, Larkspur has to keep the seat, and, you know, that I could go back and look at those letters and kind of summarize, you know, what was said at the time, just what's in the record.
Okay.
A little research project for me. That's,
yeah.
Okay. So, we are asked to review and provide direction to staff as appropriate. Do you feel like you've had adequate
direction?
Yeah, you guys have accepted all the changes with a couple of revisions in a few places, and then in the withdrawal section we have a revision, some additional language, and we'll make those changes, provide to the JPA managers, ask them to specifically have their attorneys look at the revised withdrawal section language, provide their comments. We'll bring those back to the managers at their next meeting, which is end of April, and then we'll either present everything to you or we'll cobble something together that makes sense to us and we'll present that.
Is the JPA manager the city manager of Larkspur? He gets a copy, right?
He hasn't been engaged because he said he's relying on Commissioner Helmer.
So Larkspur needs to get a copy of the...
I'll definitely send Stan Schwartz the draft JPA. I'll definitely do that. And ask him to, you know, send that.
He's aware.
Section to the attorney, yeah.
Okay. All right. And there is no member of the public for input? Any other last comments? All right.
No. I think they did a great job.
That was a good process.
I think Jason did a great job because he did a great job going to the managers, kind of sussing out some of the issues and coming up with some suggestions, which really made it much easier for the subcommittee to kind of do its work. And
kind of
we did
an
our
impossible
thing.
Then
it, yeah, but it went really smoothly. And it also was good to take it little chunks at a time and just work through.
There's a lot of good teamwork by everybody.
And Jason, you were telling us that a lot of JPAs you're talking to couldn't come close to doing revising.
Yeah, there's about 12 or 13 wastewater GPAs in the state. And I know a handful of managers, and I've talked to them about what we're doing and how, you know, constructive and productive it's been, and it's pretty agreeable, and they're just amazed.
Yeah.
They said we wouldn't open our GPA if we had to. There's no way we'd open that up. We'd be fighting, you know?
I didn't have my finger on the pulse before about 5 years ago of what was going on. By the way, Commissioner Gaffney and myself and Director Miggs all walked into another 4 years now, because there is no election, because there were three open seats and it's uncontested, so you get us for another 4 years.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice. It saves the district $40,000 and not having to put on an election. It saves us in particular, each of us, a good deal of money if we can do it. But it just seems to me that since the dark era previous to our current general manager, the district has grown up. Is participating in a good way with the rest of the agencies, and it's not contentious anymore. So I feel very good about that.
Okay. All right.
Okay, we're wrapped up with the agenda.
So that's it for the regular agenda. Moving on to the North Bay Watershed Association report. There wasn't just a regular Watershed Association meeting. It was actually their annual conference, and it was quite interesting. Michael was there. No, none of the rest of you got to go, though. Okay. It was really great. Started out, Jack Gibson, the chair, spoke. Damon Connolly spoke. The keynote speaker was Grant Davis, the general manager of Sonoma County Water Agency. He is the former, what is it, deputy...
reported to the governor.
Reported to the governor.
Department of Water Resources.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah, he moved back.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Just reading about him in the paper.
Then there was a panel discussing responding to a rising bay. I just had a couple of little snippets of information about that. Sam Shuckett, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, the executive officer for the California Coastal Conservancy. He spoke, and one fact that this is the first time I've heard this one, but he said that it's now kind of widely regarded, I suppose, that 2030 is now kind of the deadline to get your wetlands restored. If you haven't restored your wetlands by 2030, it's kind of too late. You're not going to be able to save them due to inundation. So that should be a wake-up call to everybody along the bay. Allison Brooks spoke on that panel also. She is the chair of Resilient by Design, the design competition to come up with some creative ways to deal with sea level rise. She said that there is a finance advisory team on the Resilient by Design website, and they are experts at financing a project such as sea level rise mitigation. So I, for one, want to talk to our public works about taking a look at some of those names and seeing if any of them might be able to help us out. They spoke a little bit about Measure AA, the San Francisco Bay Restoration Authority. The authority is looking for projects that are ready to build and are not too speculative. They also have a certain amount of money for approval and for environmental approval and planning. So if you have some projects that are ready, they're going to be coming out with another round of funding. They are just I think within the last week announced some winners of the first round of funding. I know Marin got some money. I don't recall the details.
Is that $10 per parcel or $11?
I believe so. Yeah, it's a Bay Area wide.
25 years.
Yeah. Is that article in the paper yesterday on that?
Yeah. The Coastal Conservancy, by the way, is experimenting with placing dredge spoils along eroding marshland edges. So not necessarily always just dumping on top, but also along the edges, because
like
I know
a,
in Cordillera. Well, or sometimes the edges, like I know Cordillera is having this issue, it's eroding because the wave action is a little more intense than it used to be, and we're losing our edges. So if you can get that right along the edge, it can help eliminate that erosion.
I think real quick, it was in this section also, they talked a lot about Highway 37.
Yes.
As being something that they really have to take care of for two reasons. First of all, it's two lanes, and it's horrible traffic. So MTC is working on that one. But the other problem is it completely blocks off a lot of the marsh infrastructure on the north end of Highway 37. And in fact, when the Highway 37 had its closure the last time we flooded in early 2017, all the models predicted it would be more towards the Mare Island side of the deal, and none of the models showed the Novato end, which actually was the part that flooded, so that they don't know, but they really need to do something, and that's part of the thing that has to get done by 2030 to restore what's north of that to help protect Petaluma, ultimately St. Rosa or Park, because the rising tides are just going to go straight up.
Now, there is some funding identified for Highway 37 under Regional Measure 3, which is a bridge toll increase that is going to be going to the voters. And I think it's in November, but I'm not 100% certain. It's either June or November of this year. Let's see. Jared Huffman spoke right after lunch. He was great, as always. Let's see. Jared said that there is some funding from the federal government for mitigation of flood and sea level rise, but he didn't get any specifics, and I sure haven't seen anything about that. But anyway, whatever that's worth. After Congressman Huffman, there was an introduction by Ryan Gregory, who's a Napa County supervisor, and then Lieutenant Colonel Travis Rayfield of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers San Francisco District spoke. Lieutenant Colonel Rayfield was really a very interesting, good speaker. He mentioned a particular report that I wanted to share. It's called The Governance Gap. It was put out by UC Davis, and it's about resiliency and the hurdles related to that. That's all I know, but it sounded like a really interesting read if you can get your hands on it. It might be online. I don't know. He talked about regulatory processes and the hurdles and kind of coming up with new ways of thinking about things and getting things done. One of the things he mentioned was that the Coastal Conservancy helped with bringing agencies together for permitting the Alviso project, which is down in San Jose, and it's right on the bay. He said Army Corps of Engineers can help with funding. I don't think they have a ton of funding, though, and this is mostly for sea level rise. But he also said Army Corps of Engineers works with local agencies to coordinate state and federal permitting. But this is more for big projects, things like working with Caltrans. But if you ever have the need, it's a good thing to maybe remember. And then he mentioned a Section 408, which is to alter an former Army Corps of Engineers project, and how, my question was how that might apply to some of the things we have in Corte Madera, which were old Army Corps projects to drain marshland and build housing developments. But in your agencies, you might be working on a site that was an Army Corps site, and if you want to change it, you might work with the Army Corps because they might help you out.
So that was one of the nice things about that nice gentleman who got up was that he took a lot of questions from some really knowledgeable people who asked good questions, and he said, I can't answer that, but I'm going to have my staff work directly with you. And he seemed like he was genuinely a good guy and not putting anybody off.
And I found out afterwards that he's only assigned to that post for 2 years. Every 2 years, they get a new person heading up that Army Corps department, which is kind of unfortunate.
Because you said what you said to everybody you met in 2 years.
Yeah. Maybe so he's close to the end of his 2 years.
You know. I'm still hiring that staff.
So it was raining very hard.
9 years.
I know.
It was raining very hard that morning, and part of what was discussed was the fire and how it came through. And somebody was actually discussing that it's not just what happened last year, and then what happened in 1963, there was a fire with the same footprint. Once about every 40 years, 40 to 50 years,
really,
it's been the same footprint. It didn't make a difference.
The ones from Calistoga that came down into towards Fountain
yeah.
Grove?
Mm-hmm. And
it's
about every 40 or 50 years there's been a fire like that.
Wow.
For as far back as we have the history of it.
Scary.
Yeah.
But what was interesting is, so you had all these captains and heads of this and that and the other from up there, the first responders, and at about 11:10 in the morning, I started hearing beep, 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 beep. Everybody's beeping, and they all kind of ran out of the room because there was flood alerts happening in Sonoma and Napa at the time because of the rains that morning.
Yeah, so we were all sitting in the Sonoma Sheraton in Petaluma. At sea level rise during a major downpour, during the high tide, of course, came through that morning. So it was quite something. Kate, did you have anything to add?
Not really. I'm just very impressed
with
the level of expertise and the speakers and the members. Yeah, it was very, very educational.
Any other questions? All right. Agenda item 10. Oral reports by commissioners and general manager. Any commissioner reports?
No. Just a couple things. This is an exhibit to the JPA that I should have mentioned during that discussion. This is produced by Ross Valley staff. It's great, and it shows all of the assets that are listed. These are the assets that are CMSA, Ross Valley, or SAN2 assets that are listed in that exhibit. And the Ross Valley staff, they're also preparing a very similar drawing that's going to show the CMSA and San Rafael SAN assets. So these will be attachments to Exhibit A.
Very good.
There's a couple things. One is that on the power delivery side, after the last board meeting, we we added all of the revisions and edits to the Marine Clean Energy Power Purchase Agreement, including the ranges of values for the Appendix D and the site plans and electrical drawings, submitted that. They eventually reviewed it, approved it all, executed the agreement. Then they gave us a 12-month extension on us complying with other requirements in the feed-in tariff application. So that was all great news. In the last few Wednesdays, we've had some participants in the Adult Offender Work Program on site. And one of our utility workers has been supervising, and they've been clearing out the storm drain ditches and doing landscaping cleanup work outside our fence line. So that's worked out pretty well. And then item five, I did have a couple lunch meetings with Al Boro. Caught up with him and, you know, had some good conversations and made sure he got his Form 700 documents in, which was good. Mm-hmm. And he's planning to resign from the CMSA board in the near future. So he and Kate are going to work on a resignation letter, and he'll send that to CMSA and to Gary Phillips in San Rafael. And after that, then we'll have a nice, you know, resolution of appreciation for Al. Try to get it on one page. It would be tough. 2-point font. You know, he's on the board for a long time.
Yeah, might have to do.
And lastly, that we mentioned this during the operation succession plan, and this pertains to the maintenance succession plan. We authorized us to hire an E&I technician in advance of Kit Grow's retirement. Mm-hmm. We've offered a condition. We made a conditional job offer to Rafael Panga for that position, and he said he's going to accept it. So that's good news.
Good.
And that's all I have.
Well, why did MCE accept our? You know, when? Why did they do it so fast? What? I don't understand.
We didn't ask them. They signed the agreement, and we were happy with that.
But if we discussed them, they wouldn't do it. Isn't that right?
Well, what we discussed with them was actually changing, you know, the definitions of product and contract capacity. We didn't change any definitions. We just included in the appendix, you know, those ranges, which in effect reduces the contract capacity and the product. So it addressed all the committee's concerns on those particular terms and definitions and all these different provisions in the agreement.
And they kind of disagree with the standard definitions that, you know, like... Okay.
So we in effect, modify the definition with these ranges, which was great.
Okay. Yeah, the only part that we were allowed to monkey with was that Appendix D, and they filled it in the way we wanted it, and they accepted it.
Excellent.
Yeah, I was really surprised and excited about that when... I got that signed agreement back.
Yeah, that's good.
That is good.
It was great work discussion by the board at the last meeting that led to that. Thank you. And that's all I have.
All right. Thank you. Next meeting is May 8th at 7 p.m. We'll see you all then. Meeting is adjourned.
Great. Thank you.
At 11 o'clock in the morning.